We'll do a couple different things tonight. One, of course, we will look carefully at the essay, and I've outlined kind of the big ideas that we'll look at, since you're not going to have time to read the whole thing. And if you take time to read the whole thing now, while I'm doing the first part, then I'll be my feelings will be hurt, so you can't do that either. I'd like to begin this presentation, and then which will eventually turn into a discussion, of course, with a performance poem. Richard Wright is best known as a novelist and an autobiographer and an essayist, and not as a poet, but he has some poetry, and he has one very fine poem. It's called Between the World and Me. And the plot of this poem will be easy to pick up on, but I want to tell you about it anyway, because the sense of this, how it fits Martin Luther King's essay, I think is very important. The plot of the poem is the persona, the speaker, the poet, whoever this person is, stumbles upon the remains of a lynching. A lynching in which the victim was stripped of his clothes, was castrated, was tied to a sapling, and then tarred and feathered and finally burned at the stake. It was not an uncommon experience in the South, and as late as 1947, there were 10 lynchings as far north as Kansas. So this is a common kind of, you know, vigilante kind of justice, as you probably know. The way I'd like to use this to set up Martin Luther King's essay is that his essay is collected in a book called Why We Can't Wait. And he's argumentative, he's theological, and sometimes he, Martin Luther King, is abstract. And the abstractions that are in the essay are really based upon only about 1.5 paragraphs in the whole essay of specific images, of specific incidents of racial inequality. So I'm going to add to that by sharing this poem with you by Richard Wright. One last thing about the poem that becomes very personal, but is also worth sharing with you, because I'm a white person of Norwegian heritage. And as I mentioned, the very first class I had, how does a white Norwegian get interested in African American lit? It's a long story. I won't tell you how, but I'll tell you what has been one of the results. I have a one-man play that I do all around the country, primarily the Midwest. And the play is made up of poetry. And it's called A Pilgrimage of Poets, and it takes the audience and myself on this journey through the human experience. And one of the poems is the one I'm going to do in a second. And I have done that poem, I don't know how many times, I started doing the show in 1986, but I'm sure 50, 100 times or so. And I had always been, up until one important time, I had always been the poet. I had been Richard Wright. I had been, as the actor in enacting this poem, I had been the black man stumbling upon the remains of the lynching. And that's an awful sight, and this imagery is powerful, and you'll know it, and you'll feel it. And then one night, doing the show in front of a primarily black audience, I became a white man stumbling upon the remains of the lynching of a black man. And I was changed forever. And so as you listen to this, let your imagination go that it doesn't matter if you're black or white or red or yellow. What happens to you as a person experiencing this incident will change and will relate to you, I think, to what the power of art and the power of poetry really is. Are there any questions about that? Okay, then the point will be to tie this in with Martin Luther King's essay. I normally have an all-black costume, so there's no distractions, and I have one prop, and I'll do that, because I have brought that along. And one morning, while in the woods, I stumbled suddenly upon the thing. I stumbled upon it in a grassy clearing guarded by scaly oaks and elms, and the sooty details of the scene rose, thrusting themselves between the world and me. There was a design of white bones slumbering forgottenly upon a cushion of ashes. There was a charred stump of a sapling pointing a blunt finger accusingly at the sky. There were torn tree limbs, tiny veins of burnt leaves, the scorched coil of greasy hemp, a vacant shoe, an empty tie, a ripped shirt, a lonely hat, and a pair of trousers stiff with black blood. And upon the trampled grass there were buttons, dead matches, butt ends of cigars and cigarettes, peanut shells, and a drained gin flask, and a whore's lipstick. Scattered traces of tar, restless arrays of feathers, and a lingering smell of gasoline. And through the morning air, the sun poured yellow surprise into the eye sockets of the stony skull. And while I stood there, my mind was frozen with a cold pity for the life that was gone. The ground gripped my feet. My heart was circled with icy walls of fear. The sun died in the sky, and the night wind muttered in the grass and fumbled with the leaves on the trees. The woods poured forth the hungry yelping of hounds, and the witnesses rose. The dry bones stirred, rattled, and lifted, melting themselves into my bones, and the gray ashes formed flesh, firm and black, entering into my flesh. The gin flask passed from mouth to mouth. Cigars and cigarettes glowed. The whore smeared lipstick red upon her lips. And a thousand faces swirled around me, clamoring that my life be burned. And then they had me, stripped me, battering my teeth into my throat till I swallowed my own blood, and the roar of my voice was drowned in the roar of theirs. As my black, wet body slipped and rolled in their hands as they bound me to the sapling, my skin clung to the bubbling hot tar falling from me in limp patches, and the down and quills of the white feathers sank into my raw flesh. And I moaned in my agony, and then my blood was cooled mercifully, cooled by a baptism of gasoline, and in a blaze of red I leaped to the skies. Pain rose like water boiling my limbs. Begging, panting, I clutched childlike, clutched to the hot sides of death. And now my face is a stony skull, staring in yellow surprise at the sun.
What for your work, Stephen?
I'm a little bit exhausted with my breath. Those are the specifics. And if you felt that, no wonder Martin Luther King says, why we can't wait. And no wonder that's the impetus of those, it's that kind of history that proves the impetus to this wonderful letter, this wonderful essay. I want to read to you why he made this response, letter from Birmingham Jail. He is in jail for nonviolent disruption and a protest. He gets a letter from several clergymen, and they say this to him. Just as we formerly pointed out that hatred and violence have no sanction in our religious and political traditions, we also point out that such actions as incite to hatred and violence, however technically peaceful those actions may be, have not contributed to the resolution of our local problem. We do not believe that these days of new hope are days when extreme measures are justified in Birmingham. They're scolding Martin Luther King for his demonstrations. And they finish their letter. When rights are consistently denied, a cause should be pressed in the courts and in negotiations among local leaders, not from the streets. We appeal to both our white and Negro citizenry to observe the principles of law and order and common sense. It's to that letter that Martin Luther King writes on the edges of a newspaper. I think he's close to the genius. He puts this down on the edges of a newspaper and kind of gets it put into a sheet of paper like a letter, and eventually it gets to all of us through different publications, of course. But he responds to that, most especially, we appeal to both our white and Negro citizenry to observe the principles of law and order and common sense. You just saw Between the World and Me. And you want to know that since the first slave ship came in 1619, there have been people fighting, arguing, taking to court, arguing with masters. All kinds of things have been done to change the injustice that's going on in America. And now they say we need to observe principles of law and order. Before we get into the essay, I'll just give you something to think about. I think that it's interesting that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments of our Constitution make slaves, abolish slavery, make slaves citizens, and give blacks the right to vote. And I think with that in mind, it's interesting that there is no amendment that gives white males the right to vote. Why? It's assumed. Now we understand a little bit more about why we can't wait, and the power of this essay, the power of the motivation for King's essay. Okay, I think the best way to do this is to drag this forward. I can do it without dropping it. Can you see it from there? Everybody, I'm going to move this. Okay. These are the ideas that we'll look at. First of all, why he writes and why he goes is motivated to action, and what he says about injustice and what he says about privileged groups. We won't look at the whole essay. It's pretty long. What he says about just and unjust laws, and his three major points about just and unjust laws are that they must square with natural law or the law of God. It's interesting right now that Clarence Thomas, the nominee for the Supreme Court, one of the criticisms people are having of him is that he's talking about, I believe, in natural law. Well, and he quotes St. Thomas of Aquinas, and then we get all kinds of philosophical and theological arguments, and nobody knows what natural law is. Well, King's got a little explanation for that. So, just laws square with natural law or the law of God. Just laws uplift personality. Just laws, and we'll explain it more carefully, deal with how the majority and the minority work together. Finally, he makes some pretty profound comments about segregation and the theological heresy of segregation. And then a little talk that directs to probably all of us, the difference between white moderates and extremists and how time and heroes are a part of that. And finally, the moral foundation for his whole concept of equal justice. Before we start, I'd like to have a pencil, write it somewhere. Though I would like these essays back because Holden saves paper, and you know how that goes. Unless you have to have it and want to read it, that's great. And you can read it, bring it back or something. But somewhere, write down, or just remember if you don't have a pencil, your two heroes. You might have 10, but limit yourself to two. Two heroes. And I say heroes, that means men and women. I don't think women can be heroes, right? Like women can be poets, you're not a poet. Okay. So write two heroes. Try to find one in fiction. If you can't, don't worry about it. Just then two real. And then one in real life. Heroes. About what happens in Birmingham. This is one of my favorite sentences in all American literature. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny.
I thought of an illustration on my way over here.
Since nobody really knows me in this crowd, I'll tell you a story. 1976, I was in a discussion with a student in class, and the discussion turned to argument, and he was vehement and soon became almost violent, and he picked up a chair and he slammed it on the ground, and I popped him in the mouth. 1976, Rock Island, Illinois. How do you feel about engaging in an argument with me?
I'm not arguing with you.
I'm not arguing with you, I'll tell you that. Right, just a quick answer. How does that make you feel? Scared? I mean, he's wacko. Well, now, before anybody leaves, let me tell you that never really happened. Never done it. But what I wanted you to feel for a moment was this: the concept of injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. This happened 2,000 miles away almost, 1976, whatever day I said, I made the whole thing up, 15 years ago. And to me, and that far away, that long ago, it still makes you feel a little uneasy. Injustice, because if I can do it to him, right, I could be a jerk enough to do it to you. Injustice anywhere. Threat to injustice everywhere. And we felt that. So that's no small motivation for King to, I've got to write this. And no, I don't live there in Birmingham. What are you doing down here in Harris? Remember, that's what the Black Civil Rights Movement, part of it was about. You Northerners, get out of here. You white folks from up north, get out of here. We'll take care of our own problems. What do we worry about South Africa for, right? Because injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. There's a theologian that said they came for the Catholics. And I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Catholic. They came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. They came for, and finally they came for me.
Martin.
Yeah, Martin. Dietrich
Bonhoeffer.
No, Martin.
Niebuhr.
Yeah. And finally they came for me, and there was no one left. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
Okay, we've kind of felt that sense of his urgency, and his sense of purpose, and his sense of motivation. Then we can skip the next page. It's worth reading, but we don't have that kind of time, right? And go, in fact, until one that says 206, at the top says necessary for growth. You with me on that? I did everything to get this right, and it's fourth page. And you have them on the back, right? Okay, on the fourth page, the bottom five or six lines of that third paragraph, the paragraph that begins one of the basic points in their statement. If you can't find it, I'm not going to read it. You can just listen to it. My friends, I must say to you that we have not made a single gain in civil rights without determined legal and nonviolent pressure. Lamentably, it is an historical fact that privileged groups seldom give up their privileges voluntarily. Individuals may see the moral light and voluntarily give up their unjust posture. But, as Reinhold Niebuhr has reminded us, groups tend to be more immoral than individuals. Two examples of that? Anybody? Groups tend to be more immoral than individuals.
Eli.
What?
Eli.
Mila. The whole army.
All the Western boys.
Well, the Midwestern boys who belong to a fraternity. I teach at a college where there are some fraternities, and it's not a real big thing, but I know that they swat people's butts in those fraternities. And I know that the guys who do that would never do that alone. And that if you've read, I have, the autobiography of Rudolf Hess, the commandant at Auschwitz, who burned 900 people a day. He says, it never crossed my mind to question what I was doing. Because what? He was part of a group. And that's, you know, the Nazi officers. Church, the slave owners. We talked about this a couple classes ago. Slave owners were justified by their religion. That made them a part of the group, and that was their ideology that justified that. Well, he understands that. Ideology dismisses personal responsibility. So we've got to counteract that, and
We've got all kinds of groups that are out there working against us, those for civil rights. And those people, and who are the people that are working against them right now that he writes the time for? The church. Just wait a minute. We understand what you want, but not so fast. What's the date? This is on the quiz now. What's the date the first landship came? Very good. That's the only quiz we'll have in the past. 1619. But we understand what you want, but don't go so fast. This is 1963, isn't it? Okay. That's why right, why action, his idea of injustice. And then I'd like to read, you have the images from Richard Wright. I think it's important to get the images from King, and at the bottom of the same page.
The name of that poem.
The name of that poem is Between the World and Me. It's in the collection of poems in the bookstore called Black Poets, edited by Dudley Randall, and that poem was in there. So it's the abortion poem that we read on the before, wherever it was. And you bought the last copy? She will be Xeroxing in the... Okay. This bottom paragraph of the next page. These are the specifics that set him up to allow his more, I think, abstract arguments. We have waited for more than 340 years for our constitutional and God-given rights. The nations of Asia and Africa are moving with jet-like speed toward gaining political independence, but we still creep at horse and buggy pace toward gaining a cup of coffee at a lunch counter. Has anybody seen those videos that have been on PBS? Eyes on the Prize. If they look in your newspaper, they're on every year, especially in February. Look in your newspaper and get a chance to see those, and you'll see the real heart of the civil rights struggle. And now there's a series of six in that. There's another series of six called Eyes on the Prize 2, Civil Rights coming after that. And it's narrated by Julian Bond, and it's really wonderful stuff. Won a lot of awards. I thought of a cup of coffee at lunch time to see the films of what went on at lunch time. Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt, that's why I did the poll, who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, when you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you speak to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television, and see tears welling up in her eyes when she is told that Funtown is closed, the colored children, and see ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky, and see her beginning to distort her personality by developing an unconscious bitterness toward white people. When you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son who is asking, Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean? When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable quarters of your automobile because no motel will accept you. When you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored. When your first name becomes nigger and your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your last name becomes John. And your wife and mother are never given the respective title Mrs. When you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly a tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with inner fears and outer resentments. And on it goes. Those are the specific images. Children, the lunch counters, the motels of rejection. Why we can't wait. Dear clergy, this is why I'm writing. Well, we're going to talk about the law. And I put on the title of this, America's Best Essay. You can share argue with me about that, and we won't fight with it. And I want to argue about all the great essays. How do you stand up to E.B. White? How do you stand up to Wendell Berry? How do you stand up to James Baldwin? This is just one of the great ones. And I, the only reason I bring that up is not to make you literary experts, but what makes an essay great? Is it, I've got this on the board up here, is it just, though this is important, is it just racial protest? If it is, it's important and it's specific and it's timely, but sometime, we hope, it doesn't have as much application. Is it just, though that's important too, social analysis? Or is it finally philosophical and theological argumentation and theological and philosophical thought that then makes the essay what? What's the word everybody learned in sophomore high school? Universal. And it applies to all people at all times. Here's a starting point. And that brings us to the next point. What are just and unjust laws? The next paragraph on the same, skip a paragraph and on the same page. Now, what is the difference between the two?
Just and unjust.
How does one determine whether a law is just or unjust? He advocates elsewhere, in this essay, that we should break laws that we consider unjust. And the first question that has to come up in thinking people is, well, then how do you prevent anarchy? You know, if we didn't all agree to stop on the red light, you know, and I'm in a hurry, I'm going to work, I'm going to go through it today. We can't do that. That's anarchy in its accident. That's crazy. He doesn't just say, you know, break the unjust laws and follow the just laws. He gives us this criteria for it too. A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. That also scared me. Because the slave owners thought it was the law of God too. And the Afrikaners in South Africa think it's their decree by God to rule over the blacks in South Africa. But he gets even more specific. He doesn't just leave it up for grabs or anybody that might hear, as somebody did in 1978, God speaking to them that they should bomb an abortion clinic down in Florida. Remember that, four people? Well, God told them that. He doesn't just leave it up for grabs like that. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. To put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal law and natural law. I'll give you some examples quickly. Natural law. When you're tired, what do you do? What does he do when he's traveling across the country? He can't see. He's in his car. When you're thirsty, what do? You drink. He can't drink because the fountain says wide open. When you're hungry, what do? You eat. And he can't eat anywhere he wants to because that coffee shop is going to be closed to blacks. That's where all the sit-ins occurred, right? On the benches in the restaurants. It's pretty natural stuff. It's so natural, in fact, that the word I use when I think about this is it's biological function. You got to sleep. You got to drink. You got to eat. That's natural law. So if it says color and white, you have an obligation, says Martin Luther King, break that law. Because that violates God's. That violates nature. The second one. Any law that uplifts human personality is just. What's the corollary of that one? Any law that uplifts personality is just, therefore, any law that... Got any examples of that in there? Yeah. Huh? Fun, great illustration. Fun Town is closed. There's a whole book about that in Langston Hughes' Not Without Laughter. In that incident, they save these tickets and they're going to go ride the Ferris wheel and they're going to go around and save all these tickets and they get up to the door and the guy says, sorry, this is for white kids only. For 2 weeks, he's been cutting out those coupons. He walks away and one of the black girls with him, the main character of the story, one of them says, I'm going to call my dad. And the main character of the story, the little kids, says, what good will that? His personality has not been uplifted. And that you got to break that law. And in that book, I think Langston Hughes would hold that gatekeeper and that ticket taker accountable. He had a couple options he could do. Go on in, kids. I don't care what the law says. I might get fired, but you go on in. Or, sheriff's tickets to quit his job and I can't work with this anymore. But somehow, King says, you got to break the law. But most of the great scene in that novel, again, it's not love after that. The great scene in the novel is the guy takes the ticket and he says, not unkindly, sorry, this carnival is for white kids. He's nice to him. But he preserves what? The status quo. And by preserving the status quo, contributes to perpetuating more injustice and perpetuating personality that is not unkind. Okay. And the third one.
unjust if it is inflicted on a minority that, as a result of being denied the right to vote, had no part in enacting and revising the law. Outright above that, he says, an unjust law is a code that a numerical, that's America, majority, or power, that's South Africa, majority, group compels a minority group to obey, but does not make binding on itself. That is also unjust. And that's fundamental stuff. So now we have a kind of criteria for following our conscience. Just or unjust laws isn't just that voice of God speaking to us that sometimes, you know, harkens on the crazy people. It's something that's pretty specific. Then he talks about segregation and gives it a theological context. It's not just a matter of equal schooling. It's not just a matter of being able to drink water. It's a matter of the whole creation and the self. And psychologically, it's self-esteem, and theologically, it's love. It's redemption. And I love it at the top of the same page. Segregation gives the segregator a false sense of superiority, and the segregated a false sense of inferiority. Segregation, to use the terminology of the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, substitutes an I-it relationship for an I-thou relationship. It ends up relegating persons to the status of things, of course. In a way, that poem does that, doesn't it? All of a sudden, yeah, I gave you a statistic deliberately. There were 10 blacks lynched in Kansas in 1947. It's a number. There were 6 million Jews killed in World War II. It's a number. Until you know one survivor of the Holocaust. Or until you've been on your knees with one black person who has been subjected to a lynching. Then it becomes I, thou, not I, it. So segregation has profound, doesn't it? And you can think of more. Theological support, rebuttal. Okay. Finally, and then it's going to be your turn in a moment here, white moderates versus extremists. When we come to that, who are your heroes? Put your right down or who did you remember? I'll write some of them down while we go. Who are they? Kennedy. K-E-N-N. Those of you who have been with me before know I can't spell for Diddley. Kennedy.
Gandhi.
Dorothy Day.
John.
Glenn. Roosevelt.
Black Elk.
John Wayne.
Are you from Iowa?
Minnesota, so am I.
You got many more. What's your criteria? My heroes, by the way, were Jesus and Huckleberry Finn. Right in the same category. Anybody read the Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison?
My hero in that. You've become one of my American literature heroes as Pilate Dead.
What are your criteria for your heroes? Okay, you can go home. Good. They have to have respect. Good answer.
Courage.
What?
Courage.
Courage. Good answer. Somehow that's in there, isn't it? Somehow they reach out beyond themselves. Good.
Vision.
Boy, if we put that up like this, there's vision. Most people see down the tunnel. Somehow our heroes have had something beyond that. And Martin Luther King becomes, for some people, we know, right, is a hero. Because, if he had been standing there giving appearance, I think he would have said, is there another way to do this? I mean, there is. If you tear up the thing, so the kid go in, and the sky is not going to fall. One of the great concepts that Richard Wright brings to us in all his fiction is that women and men need to differentiate between artificial law and absolute law. Absolute law is, when you jump down here, you know, it's gravity. And if you jump down far enough, you're going to wreck your arches. Far enough yet, you're going to wreck your arches. Artificial law is you sit in the back of the bus. But for so long, artificial law was interpreted as absolute law. I mean, and so blacks are in the back of the bus, and whites are in the front. When the white man comes and sees no seats, he goes back to the black woman, and she stands up and gives her a seat. It's absolute law. And then one day, Rosa Parks didn't give her seat away. And the sun came up the next day anyway. And the wind blew, and the river flowed, and the lakes got waves on them, and all kinds of natural laws continued, and the whole world, you know, shame, a lot of things like that. Somehow our heroes do that, don't they? They envision beyond, and that's what extremists are. And the moderate is the person. Good people. Nice people. They make good bread, do well, you know, plow up their fields really well, do a good job in the classroom, think of all the professions you can. And they see things the way they are. Look at King's language for that. From where you were, it's the next page. The second whole paragraph, I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the past 2 years, I have been greatly disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor, which is a real, you know, anti-black group, or the Ku Klux Klan, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. We all get it. What have those clergymen read about? We must appeal to reason and to law and order. Okay? A negative peace, which is the absence of tension. I mean, I think they're all thinking of how we try to do that even in our own homes. Right? Go to your room. I mean, we haven't resolved anything, but we've gotten rid of the tension, right? Except inside your heart, where you're letting it. But that's the common vision. The extremist has another vision. There's another illustration in the book called The Negro Move, and later changed to the Black Move by Lerone Bennett, a sociologist and a teacher at the University of Chicago. And Lerone Bennett tells the illustration of John Brown, a white abolitionist at Harper's Ferry, and all gave his life for justice and for rights. John Brown comes to a bunch of white men in the city and says, slavery is evil, kill it. And here are the responses that I think Lerone Bennett somewhat fictionalizes to make his point that applies to our consideration of a white moderate and extremist. Slavery is evil, kill it, says John Brown. We need time, says the men who are there. Slavery is evil, kill it. We'll form a committee. Slavery is evil, kill it. We need to study the issue. Slavery is evil. Kill it. We will research the history. Slavery is evil. Kill it. Point is clear. Every time I read it, I think George Bush is on acid rain. We'll get a committee. The same word. We'll form a committee, we're going to need more time, we're going to study the issue, we're going to look at the history and the else. Okay. Acid rain is evil. Kill it. Slavery is evil. Kill it. It becomes, for this guy who can't wait, there are no arguments anymore. It's time for end the committees, and you get the point. And then the last thing that sets us up, and that's where your heroes are, and that's why I asked that question at first. And that's why they strung up Jesus, right? Because he had too radical a vision. And we all know that story well. And it seems as though those radicals get done away with, don't they? Don't the Martin Luther King and the Malcolm X's in our society and the Gandhis and the others, somebody's going to murder them because their vision. And yet those are the ones we respect somebody's word the most. The third to the last page, the fourth, where am I? No, just one more page over, I guess. The second paragraph, I had also hoped that the white moderate would reject the myth concerning time in relation to the struggle for freedom. I have just received a letter from a white brother in Texas. He writes, all Christians know that the colored people will receive equal rights eventually, but it is possible that you are in too great a religious hurry. I'm skipping about five lines, and then came to the spot that I love. Actually, time itself is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively, more and more, I feel, if the people of ill will can use time much more effectively than have the people of good will. I think about that essay, what I had just last year, a college freshman, I coached too, Keith English, my coach track, this kid and freshman came in. He was just a sot, he wanted to quit school, he wanted to get out of everything, because his girlfriend broke up with him. And that's no small thing. College freshman, you've been going to there for 2 years. I asked him, well, what are you doing? He said, you still have a picture on your wall?
Yeah.
What do you do with their letters? I bet you're reading every night, one of them. Yeah, I do. I gave him an assignment. I said, you send a picture back, you burn the letters, and you take out your lab button. Well, he did that. Time doesn't heal wounds. Action does. Time, and that's things like time is neutral. This kid was doing an action, a positive in this case, a negative action, that was adding to his grief, right?
I mean, this is going on.
Say that all the time. It didn't help him. So he gets rid of all that stuff. He takes some steps forward, and all of a sudden, time, this is again, time itself is neutral. It can be used destructively or constructively. We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. I say that and then I remind you again. All Christians know. He says it, and then later. The appalling silence of the good people. On the next page, the bottom, is about Jesus as an extremist. The greatest example of a king of extremism, of radicalism, that he can find. And he has some others there too. And then if we'll skip that, Jesus is on the bottom of that page, and then go two more pages at the top where it is, when I was suddenly catapulted. In fact, looking at time, we're going to skip that page and go two more. At the top, this is the nation. This is the second to the last page. It's on your last page, and the left-hand side, right? Top, okay. Second paragraph there. Before closing, I feel impelled to mention one other point in your statement that has troubled me profoundly. You warmly commended the Birmingham police force for keeping order and preventing violence. See, that's an ironic kind of argument, because that's what King is most for. That's the struggle between King and Malcolm X, right? King wants nonviolence and demonstration, and Malcolm X says, any way we can get it. So some other people you think are nonviolent, right? The right hand said, any way we can get it. Justice. That's irrelevant right now. Okay. You warmly commended the Birmingham police. I doubt that you would have so warmly commended the police force if you had seen the dogs sinking their teeth into unarmed, nonviolent Negroes. I doubt that you would so quickly commend the policemen if you were to observe their ugly and inhumane treatment of Negroes here in the city jail. Skip down to the next paragraph. It is true that the police have exercised a degree of discipline in handling the demonstrators. In this sense, they have conducted themselves rather nonviolently in public. Here we're getting into this tough issue. Students always have a hard problem with it. The difference between the means and the end. The end is justice. And for King, the means is nonviolent. Now, the Birmingham police are using moral means to King, that is, nonviolence, to achieve an immoral end. Preservation of segregationists. Okay. They conduct themselves in a nonviolent way, but for what purpose? To preserve the evil system of segregation. Over the past few years, I have consistently preached that nonviolence demands that the means we use must be as pure as the ends we seek. I have tried to make clear that it is wrong to use immoral means to attain moral ends. No, Malcolm, not violence. That's immoral means, but even though it's to a moral end. The King has bought into, I bought it in all work, has decided that there's some valid validity to the non-election situation too, or that philosophy too, because, but now I just refer, it is just as wrong, and perhaps even more so, to use moral means to preserve immoral ends. Perhaps Mr. Connor and his policemen have been rather nonviolent in public, as was Chief Pritchett in Albany and all the jury. But they have used the moral means of nonviolence to maintain the immoral end of racial injustice. Here is a phrase to take out of
king forever, I think. It is finally his philosophical, theological argument that motivates the whole essay. As T.S. Eliot has said, the last temptation is the greatest treat, to do the right deed for the wrong reason. And then we have all kinds of thought, especially all the sessions I've gone through, about our environment, about our own Christianity, about civil rights and equal justice among women and men. To do the right deed for the wrong reason. And then the rest of the essay is kind of concluded. Fire away with all kinds of thoughts about your experiences, or responses now from your guts. First place to start is from your guts. And I believe that you start from your guts and then it gets to your head. Anybody have anything they want to add or ask? Yes?
If you put King on one side of the spectrum and Malcolm X on the other side, which do you feel is getting the more of a hearing from young blacks today?
I don't know. Does anybody know? I guess that's where I would lean to. It's an exacerbation. It's a buildup of that. Why we can't wait. It's most evident, I think, in South Africa right now. The violence. I mean, they say, come on, don't have violence. The South Africans, the blacks, have asked the whites to come to the table since 1912. Let's meet and negotiate. I mean, that's the Martin Luther King way, right? Frustration keeps building, and the same in America, too. And there's another kind of frustration now in the 90s and the late 80s that was kind of present in the 60s that caused blocks in Chicago and Newark and Detroit and New York, the burnings there, and that kind of